Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
Look, all I can tell you is that garnering attention and eyeballs is more important than it's ever been in the history of humanity when it comes to getting people to advertise with you, spend money on you, buy tickets from you, consume you, want a new ballpark built for you. The A's just don't have enough attention to have anything done anymore. And why is figure that out on another show. We're just dealing with the reality. The reality is the A's have about 30,000 people in an area of 7.5 million that are interested in what they do on a day-to-day basis. And that's it. That's why it's just the most boutique thing that works. And boutique broadcasting doesn't get it done anymore.
That may be true in broadcasting, but those are not inevitable and unchangeable. They could change this. And it would take a lot of hard work and it would take a lot of money that wouldn't have an immediate return.
Right. I mean,
there's the problem. It's that the stadium is for them an immediate return, and the $850 million that they want from the city is an even more immediate return. Baseball, attention, all those things, they're investments. And if you're not willing to invest, if you need to have the quarterly report show how much value you got out of spending that money, then it's not going to work. You have to be there and continue to be there and be there even after people are tired of hearing it from you. The A's have never done that. They've always just sort of, well, the Giants get all the attention, we give up. Well, you know what? No, you don't give up. You put a finger in their eye whenever you can. You make your own noise. You not only put the winning team on the field, which they've done, but you do it in such a way that you make Giants fans notice. It can be done. It's been done in the past. That team in the late 80s that you were talking about, they had enormous personalities at nearly every position. Dave Henderson was a great talker. Dave Stewart was a great talker. Dave Parker, Don Baylor, Canseco, McGuire. They had characters that fit the town, and it's why they drew 2.9 million people. Within 5 years, all those guys were gone. They were replaced with cheap replacements. And all of a sudden people went, no, show us something else. And that's when it all went bad because they didn't show them something else. What they did was say, well, we'll give you good baseball, but we're going to tell you how cheaply we're doing it. That's not a message. People love the trade deadline in every sport because they like to feel money burning. They love that. It's an aphrodisiac for them. You traded five guys to get four others, and one of those guys is going to make $35 million a year? Cool. It's voyeurism, but that's part of what you're talking about, which is making noise. The A's don't make noise because it's not in their immediate momentary financial interest to do that, which is why they are in the position they're in today. And it's why, unless they do something extraordinary, and winning a World Series is only the start of that, they're gonna end up as dismissible as they are right now. Because the worst thing you could have done as the team's going good, is to change the narrative so that it's all about, I'm holding up a city during COVID because I want what I want today, even though I might not even want it. I don't want you to talk about the baseball team. I want you to talk about the real estate deal. The real estate deal doesn't get attention. What it gets is scorn.
And that is where they have really misplayed their hands. Just once again, the old Chinese proverb, you know, the best time to plant a tree was 25 years ago. The second best time is today. Today, the A's are a first-place team. Today, the A's have Sean Manaea going. Yesterday, they had James Caprillion winning his first ever game. Does anyone care? Does anyone care anymore that this is happening, or can you even invest in this? I mean, I saw Rick Tittle the other day, who was Mr. Like, I love the A's, saying, yeah, it's great that they've won two in a row in Boston, but there's just a pall hanging over every single moment, every inning, every at-bat. They never let off this feeling like, hey, you're falling in love with the wrong gal.
It goes back to what I've been talking about with the Super League and the English soccer teams. People are willing to put up with nearly anything as long as the illusion that the team matters is front and center. This is not about the team matters. This is about the owner's desire matters. This is about the real estate matters. This is about the money from the government matters. And frankly, those are all three massive drags. The best thing that the Giants did when they built their ballpark was wave the flag that no city money will be involved in this. We're going to take out bank loans. It took that part of the equation out of the discussion. And even though ultimately in the end, they did get $100 million from the city for infrastructure improvements, and they do get to charge the city for security, and that goes on now. They made the narrative sound like, we're building you a ballpark, not you're building us a ballpark. The A's have blown that.
Yeah, no, they have.
The A's have blown that. And the fact is, it's not that the ballpark down the road is so magnificent. It's that it didn't cost nearly what this one's going to.
Well, the Giants didn't want to build a neighborhood. They wanted to build a baseball stadium.
No, but they wanted the advantages to come from being in the neighborhood. That's why they put the stadium where it was.
Right, and then they're going to go ahead and build around it. The A's, who get nothing all at once, want this now all at once, and that's why it really doesn't add up. And just answering a few questions that are coming in on the text line real quick, someone wants to know the name of the theoretical physicist, Michael Goldhaber, G-O-L-D-H-A-B-E-R. Michael Goldhaber is the name of the guy who kind of launched the thought of
this
whole
thing.
When
did he write that? What year?
I don't know when he wrote this, because this was an article about him. He got contacted recently because he was identified as somebody who saw everything. Like, he saw the internet in the 80s and warned everybody all these things were going to happen. And everything he basically warned everybody about is happening right now. So
see, you never go broke betting against people.
There you go. Thank you. I knew you'd like that an awful lot. Somebody says here, the A's were not successful on 95.7 The Game because you were trying to compete with KNBR on hoovering the Giants. The monopoly is real. Let's assume for a moment, let's just say that you're right, and we had shows that were spending way too much time on the Giants. Then the A's game would come on, and you figure, as an A's fan, maybe you didn't listen to the show that talked about the Giants, but now it's the game, and you didn't listen to that either. A's fans, if they were real with themselves, would admit they don't even consume their team very much. You can't average 8,000 in attendance and tell me that you're in. You know, I mean, there are, come on. There is no doubt that we do better business by talking about the Giants than the A's, because more people want to hear about the Giants than the A's. And when you'd think, all right, well, now it's officially time to give the A's a stage all to themselves, the entire audience leaves the arena. That's what happened. That's why we're not in business. It wasn't because we were talking about the Giants. It's because when the A's game was on, our audience left. If you think for a second that we would not do the thing that earned the station the most amount of money, you are out of your flipping minds. That's the way this is built. Every station wants a great relationship with a hometown team that does something to really bring people into the tent. Nobody comes into the A's tent. Not to watch, not to watch baseball, not to do business. It didn't happen. And this team, this station did everything it could. Everything it could. We were the A's flagship station longer than any other station in the history of Bay Area radio. What did it get us? Nearly reprogrammed to a country station again. I'm just being honest with you. I know you want to hear beautiful, rainbowy things like, oh, yeah, you know, I mean, when the A's announced they're like that they were leaving the station, Dave Cavill, unprofessional as hell. Unprofessional as hell. Put that tweet out like, it's not you. Or it's not us. It's you. You wish, Dave. It's 100% you. It was 100% you. We couldn't sell you to people who buy advertising on the radio. It wasn't us. It was you. 888-957-9570. We're about an hour away from saying hello to Steve Kerr. Obviously, big doings for the Warriors. I keep on looking at the schedule for the Niners. All I see is W's. I looked at it again, Ray. It's a W there. There's a W there. I was going to put an L here. I'm not. I'm going to put a W there. That's a W, baby. Damon Ratto and Kolsky here on 95.7 The Game. We're brought to you by Workman Law. The California Supreme Court made clear that employees must be compensated for mandatory exit searches done off the clock. For information on this, call Workman Law Firm, 844-99-WORKMAN. That's 844-99-WORKMAN. Damon Ratto and Kolsky, 95.7 The Game.
Damon Ratto and Kolsky continues on 95.7 The Game.
In about an hour, Steve Kerr joins us here to talk about how they're going to wrap up their regular season, the play-in, the heater that Steph and Draymond are on right now, the fact that they beat the Suns without even Steph on a heater. That's something else. Steve Kerr joins us around 5:20 this afternoon here on 95.7 The Game. Today, Ray, you know, we were just talking about attention. How do you get and hold people's attention? And if you really wanted to ask, why was Larry Scott fired? And let's not be disingenuous here. Larry Scott was basically fired. I know that he's like,
he decided that he's stepping down.
He was told to go away because all of his ideas have been really, really bad for the Pac-12 conference. He was not Larry Scott let go because this team failed to put teams in the conference champ or in the national championship game in football. He was not let go because, well, you know, it took Oregon and UCLA to reach a Final Four, to have a Pac-12 team reach a Final Four for the first time in a long time. You know, so it's got nothing to do with on-field failure or success. Larry Scott is out of the room because he came up with a network that you couldn't find on your television, which is kind of a problem if you're launching a network. Mike Fortuna of The Athletic was writing about the fact that the Pac-12 appeared to make a very reach hire, but the truth is it's a modern hire. MGM executive George Kliavkoff. I'm going to screw this up. Couldn't they have hired a guy named George Smith? God. I mean, Larry Scott had one thing going for him. He really did. He had one thing going for him. I can pronounce that. George Kliavkoff. Kliavkoff, Kliavkoff, Nikolai Volkov, George Kliavkoff. He is the next commissioner of the Pac-12. He was president of MGM Entertainment and Sports. He's 54 years old. He was approved with a unanimous vote of Pac-12 presidents and chancellors, and he's got a five-year contract that now begins on July 1st. He spent 3 years at MGM Resorts. Previously worked for Hulu and NBC. He also served on the WNBA Board of Governors and was the Executive Vice President of Business for MLB Advanced Media in the early 2000s. You heard that the next commissioner had to come from a football savvy conference, somebody from the SEC, something. This guy comes from network programming, basically. And if that doesn't let you know that this isn't about amateur athletic, folks. This is about making money on television now, and that's all it is. His hire almost gives up the game, Ray.
It does, but here's the one thing that his hire doesn't do. It doesn't give the Pac-12 a guy in charge with full knowledge of the politics of college athletics.
No, it doesn't.
So he's got to figure that out on the fly. And not just walking into the room and saying, we need to expand the college football playoffs, is not enough. And him sort of talking about name, image, and likeness legislation, when he'll be talking with people who are largely against it, that's going to take some work too. He is still an outsider in that part of it. He'll be better at getting the conference more attention, but in terms of how college athletics works, at a time when the NCAA is weaker than ever, and three or four conferences run all of it, the Pac-12 is not one of those. And the one thing we know about the way corporate America is settled is the people in charge don't want other people having a say in the room if they don't need it. So that's the uphill battle he's got. Yeah, he's got a background at baseball. He's got a background at the WNBA. He does have a background with with gaming. He's got all those things. The one thing he doesn't have is sort of a comfortable knowledge about how to deal with the people who actually run this stuff, because as it becomes more lucrative, it becomes more about a few places in the South and Midwest that take in the money and make sure that they're taken care of first.
Well,
and that's where he's got to get really good really fast, is making it clear that college sports needs the West Coast and it needs the Eastern Seaboard and it needs the parts of the country that it is largely abandoned.
Yeah, no, college football's overall health can't be relegated to just the flyover states. You got to get both East and West involved. And you talk about building consensus and being able to work a room full of 12 different schools, all with their own agendas, and getting it all into one. Well, in what is maybe the most perfectly named school president ever, Oregon school president, Michael Schill. Could you find a better name for a president? Michael Schill. Michael H. Schill says about George Kliakov, he is the new prototype for a sports commissioner. He led the five-member search committee, by the way, so he's probably gung-ho on the hire.
Yeah.
While George has deep sports experience, his biggest asset is the ability to listen, connect with diverse groups, and find common ground, collaborate, and navigate an evolving landscape. Let me translate that for you. He knows how to make money on television.
Yeah, I mean, he ran Hearst cable operations for a number of years, and Hearst is a big, although unnamed, player in the cable business.
It's a modern hire. It's a TV network hire. It's not a guy who knows how to make a home-and-home schedule between USC and Alabama. It's not that. It's not what he does. He knows network television. He knows eyeballs. He knows imprinting a brand using media to do it. And due to the fact that he has just been the MGM executive, he obviously knows Vegas like the back of his hand. And when you're looking to get yourself back into the conversation, the way the Pac-12 is going to be looking at, it's time to just dump all your scruples right on the front porch of nonsense, because that's where the entire NCAA is living now, and say, how do you make the most amount of money possible? And teaming up with some sort of gaming company, this is the official gaming partner of USC football, it's only a matter of time. Look, it's only a matter of time before the notion of calling college sports amateur athletics is dead. Everyone knows that, and we're pivoting towards that, and that's what this guy's hire does. I would take this guy's hire into a courtroom and say, here's proof positive that this isn't about student-athletes anymore. This is about television deals. That's all it is.
Here's the problem. The commissioner of the Pac-12 is now going to have to fight with all 12 of those school presidents, because when you said the official gaming partner of USC Athletics, that's a deal that the school makes and doesn't want to share with the rest of the conference. He's got to figure out a way to keep those 12 university presidents, whatever they're going to do about gambling, just as an example, that they all have to sign on to the same thing, rather than the big schools cut their own deals and the small schools have to scramble for whatever they can get. That's how you destroy a conference. One of the things that the SEC has always been good at is making sure that Alabama gets its, but Mississippi State gets its too. And that's why people wanted to go into that conference, not leave it. And so it's his resume looks great, but it's the politics that are going to prove whether he can do this or not. Larry Scott was bad at the politics. And, you know, there, of all the other things that he got ripped for, he could never really get his vision put before his 12 presidents and have everybody sort of like it. And when it needed to be tweaked, he wasn't there to tweak it. You know, it's a multi-layered hire that on its face looks out of the box. But the next level is, boy, but he really knows stuff that the Pac-12 isn't good at. But the third part is trying to reassert their place as a Power 5 conference at a time when they're not.
Not that you want to show up into the brand new room and say, hi, everybody, I'm the new bully in town. But one of the messages that I would be throwing out to any single chancellor or president is that if you guys knew what you're doing, Larry Scott would still be here. And if you argued about him and how he did it, look where that got you. You're going to want to trust me here. I got a 5-year deal. Shut up. Let me get to work. That would be a smart thing for him to say, because everybody's individual priorities haven't gotten the Pac-12 very, very far. And I'll tell you where Larry Scott really signed his own death warrant was his ability to prioritize what was important. Today, George Kliakoff stepped up to a podium and said, it's about football and basketball. Everything else is secondary. And he's right. And Larry Scott tried to be, let me tell you about the importance of Arizona State women's tennis. And let me tell you how we're going to start being the exclusive streaming of Pac-12 softball. And yawn is the only reaction his entire network ever received. He never put them on the one place that all the diehard football fans are. If you were a diehard football fan, you were on DirecTV because they had the NFL ticket package, and that's where diehard football fans were. And they couldn't get on DirecTV. And you got a network that isn't even carried in the town that it's based in. Like, I can't tell you, it's impossible to be more of a media joke than to run a network that's not even cleared in the market your network does business in.
It was partly that, but it was also the structure under which that those football deals worked, and that some of it went to Fox, some of it went to ESPN, some of it went to CBS. They parceled all that out so that what was left for the network, such as it was Washington State, Oregon State. And even if those teams were good, it was still not servicing, you know, big markets. It was Corvallis, it was Pullman. The fact is, they, by not being able to figure out a way to get important events on the network, to make big DirecTV think, man, maybe this is something we'd like to have, those were already signed off on, because ESPN came in with upfront money, and so did Fox, and so did CBS. They were trying to have it all, and frankly, in this part of the country, college sports has been overtaken by the pros. There are only a few places where there is no direct competition from a professional team or teams, and that's Washington State, the two Oregon schools, and Tucson. Everywhere else, there's a pro footprint, and in a lot of places, it's a huge footprint, which meant that they had to figure out ways to become important on their own, and not getting into the playoff mattered, not having deep runs in the NCAA tournament mattered, and it wasn't so much that they were giving you sort of small events, because the Big Ten Network does a lot of that too, because they got a lot of programming time. The SEC does that too, but they had
Penn State, Michigan State.
They had Penn State, Michigan State, but they also had parts of the country where college football was the where college sports was everything.
Yeah.
The Pac-12 is at a basic geographic disadvantage because this is a place where pro teams went. And that's going to be another thing he's going to have to overcome. And I don't know that he can because those teams aren't going to leave.
USC. Bigger than any team in L.A. but the Lakers.
But they have to be the best team in the country for that to happen. And that hasn't happened in a long time.
Todd Helton is doing more to kill this conference than maybe any commissioner decision.
You mean?
Yeah. Who's
Clay Helton.
Clay Helton. Clay Helton. Clay Helton.
I wish it was
Thank
Todd
you. Todd Helton.
Yeah.
Now batting. Sorry.
But.
Probably couldn't be worse. Actually,
right.
I know
yeah.
he couldn't be worse.
No, Todd Helton would have done a better job.
No, but the fact is they haven't won. Nobody from the Pac-12 has won a national championship since 2004. So this predates him. And the truth is, the thing that killed USC as a national power is the fact that every school in the Big Ten and the Big 12 and the SEC has been recruiting LA for years and getting the best players because that's where the biggest return is in those three conferences. If you're a great college player and Nick Saban walks into your room and, you know, Mario Cristobal walks into your room, two very good coaches, you're going to Alabama.
Goes all the way back to the sanctions from the Reggie Bush and Pete Carroll days.
It does.
Never recovered.
Part of it, no, there's no doubt. There's no doubt that it diminished the most important brand the conference had.
Okay, but you cannot run a conference if you're going to make sure that one team is taken care of more than the others. It's the real problem is
okay,
that...
Let me introduce Alabama to you. Ohio State and Michigan. Right?
Auburn.
Come on.
I mean, it's, you know, there are plenty of teams that do huge business in the SEC. Alabama is the best of the football schools, but Auburn has not been a disgrace. Florida has won national championships. There are a number of places in the SEC where championships are not an unreasonable expectation. If you decide that USC has to get taken care of, then you've got problems with 11 other schools. That's not the problem.
The commissioner takes care of USC. USC's got to take care of itself,
okay,
obviously,
but,
too.
Yeah, no, USC has to take care of itself. But bred into that is the notion that when USC takes care of itself, it doesn't want to share the spoils of what it's gotten.
Yeah, but that's every school, Ray. That's all schools, all campuses, all conferences.
But,
it's not unique to the Pac-12 in any way, shape,
or
form.
No, but the Pac-12 is coming from a place of profound disadvantage because their strength is in the conference. In the SEC, they've already taken care of that by making sure that Mississippi State fills their stadium every week that they're playing at home. I mean, the only place that they struggle to fill is Vanderbilt. Everywhere else, that place is filled all the time. And so if this is just going to be about taking care of USC, the Pac-12 will fail again because you can't just plant one flag and make it cover five states.
Right. Look, every school's got to sell its own tickets, Ray. Period.
But it's more than that. It's everything. It's everything. And the fact is the Pac-12 works from a place of disadvantage in so many ways. And Lucas only brought up USC because he went there. You know, I mean, I mean, the fact is the Pac-12, you know, has basically maneuvered its way out of Power Five business because they haven't done the business right and they haven't done the power right. And that's because in large part, the SEC, the Big Ten, the Big 12, and to a lesser extent, the ACC, have taken over their business. They take their best players. They get the best TV contracts. And they're not going to give any of that up. That's why George Kliavkov is fighting an uphill battle, because he's trying to reassert a hegemony that the Pac-12 hasn't had for 20 years. Because that's what you're talking about.
It starts with people putting eyeballs on the product. And that's what his job is.
Well, then he's got to redo all those TV contracts that bring in what money they have. And he's got to make it so that you can get the Pac-12 network everywhere. And DirecTV is not the only one, not the only company that said, we'll pass on it. They don't have the product. and they don't have the product for a bunch of different reasons. That's what he's got to fight. And he's got to do that in such a way that Washington State benefits from USC as much as USC does. And if he can't do that, this fails too. Because USC is not Alabama, not even close to it anymore. And that's been going on for a while. It is hard to turn an ocean liner around.
It is. And all the schools have to do their own, you know, you grow your brand, you grow your product. The conference can only do you so much. And you talk about all the homogeny that the SEC has. If you think Mississippi helps Mississippi State sell a single ticket other than on the days they're playing each other, they don't.
No, but the entire conference has figured out a way over time to make every game a sellout everywhere. In that way, Alabama does help Mississippi State. And in that way, Mississippi State does help Florida, because that's the deal. Everybody gets fat off everybody else. And even though Alabama might take a bigger share than Kentucky does, it's still a pretty good share for everybody. The big failing of the Pac-12 network is that it gave no big share to anybody. It was a money drain. And that's what I mean by that, is you've got to make sure that you set up a system where everybody benefits. And even if it isn't equal to the last penny, there still has to be benefit for everyone. And the Pac-12 has failed to do that, and it's now going on, like I said, 2 decades.
Larry Scott's biggest mistakes were moving it from Walnut Creek into San Francisco, paying that exorbitant rent for a network that can't even take care of itself. The other huge mistakes that Larry Scott made is that while no one else is high on the hog, you can't be high on the hog. The Pac-12 network would, or the Pac-12 tournament would be in, you know, Vegas, playing at the Orleans is where they would have that. I don't know if you've ever been to the Orleans. I have. I've been in that, and it's a fine gym when you're sitting in it. But the Orleans, as a facility goes, it's off strip, baby. It's more of a local yokel place than it is a place a tourist would go. And then we look at, where would Larry Scott stay? Is he taking one of those comped rooms at the Orleans? Oh, no. What is he? He's got a $9,000 a night corner suite at the Cosmo? The conference isn't even playing on the strip. Why is he at the Cosmo in the Hey, How Are You suite?
That was his. Those were all his personal failures.
He screwed that up.
He screwed that up big time, and it's what lost him support eventually by even the presidents who kept defending him. Even moving the conference from Walnut Creek to San Francisco, while it was a money drain, it wasn't the reason why he got fired. They'd have put up with all of that if he could have delivered on the stuff that we've been talking about. And that's where the failing comes. It wasn't where the network was. It was the fact that the network didn't have anything that anybody wanted to watch ever. And in large part, that's because most of the West Coast has already signed off on pro stuff.
Well, but here's the thing, where it does matter where your network is, because the square footage that they were paying for here made your, like, just to turn the lights on cost of running your network for the year in the 20s to 30s to 40s of millions of dollar range, where had it been based in Fresno, you're paying like $11 a square foot.
But it's all worth it if you get the big stuff right. He didn't get either of it right.
Right.
Which meant that putting it in San Francisco suddenly became a huge thing, when in fact, under normal circumstances, it wouldn't have been if they had gotten the big business right. And like I said, the Pac-12's biggest disadvantage, and the one thing they can't do anything about, is that they are trying to do big business in a place where the big business in sports has been done by pro teams in 5 different sports. And that's the problem they've got. Where they played the tournament in Vegas. What does Vegas now have? They have a hockey team and a football, an NFL team. They got 3 places out of 12 schools that doesn't have a direct pro competitor. And that sucks a lot of energy out of the room, too. I mean, Stanford and Cal used to sell out routinely. That doesn't happen anymore, even though they both downsized their stadiums. You know, SC doesn't sell out anymore, even though they've been in the same place forever and ever and ever. It just, they are fighting against things that are much bigger than they are, and they don't know how to catch up. And I think that's the thing that's his biggest problem. George, he's got competition that Kevin Warren didn't have in the Big Ten, and that Greg Sankey doesn't have in the SEC. I mean, they are the major leagues. This is a place where they share space with the major leagues, and they don't share a lot of it.
It's an uphill battle, no doubt. George Kliakoff, your new Pac-12 commissioner, good luck. Good luck. We're definitely going to try to get him on the show as soon as possible to talk about how he's going to go about breathing some life back into the conference. When we come on back, so 49ers schedule officially released. I've seen it build as the easiest in football. I've seen it build as one of the easiest in football. Nobody is saying it's a hard schedule. What does it mean? How did it become that way? We're going to get into all of that. And then remember, coming up at 5:20 today, we've got Steve Kerr joining us here on 95.7 The Game. In the meantime, we are brought to you by Fremont Bank, full service banking, no compromises.
Damon, Ratto, and Kolsky continues on 95.7 The Game.
Welcome back. Good to have you here. We're jumping on into our longest commercial-free segment of the entire day. And when we're about halfway through it at 20 after 5, Steve Kerr is supposed to be joining us to talk about, obviously, the big wins over Utah and Phoenix. What's coming up tonight between the fact we've got the Memphis Grizzlies playing the biggest Memphis Grizzlies game in Warriors history without the Warriors even being involved. They got the Sacramento Kings tonight. Got to keep an eye on what the Grizzlies are doing the next two nights in a row. We'll see what the Warriors are doing against the Pelicans tomorrow night. How they approach that game tomorrow night will be a direct result of whatever happens in Memphis tonight. And Steve Kerr is joining us for all of those reasons coming up a little bit later on as we move into our 5 o'clock hour. Meanwhile, as I've been saying, Ray, I've been looking at this 49ers schedule.
I know you hate it.
I know you hate it. I'm not going to pretend to go through it and put 17 W's down right now, but I do want to go through this schedule that I've seen, like I said, build is the easiest in football. Okay, if that's what it really is, fantastic, because it's officially time to win for the 49ers. Just five of their 14 opponents, Ray, possessed a record greater than 500 last season. And as you and I have kind of already discussed, I don't know where it falls on the easy scale, but what we can agree on right now is that it doesn't fall into the hard schedule side of the scale. There is no Tampa on this schedule. There is no Kansas City on this schedule. There is no Pittsburgh on this schedule. You are not playing the Ravens. This is a lot of the really good teams. You don't even see them.
That's true, but this is all based on the 2020 teams. Somewhere in here are teams that are going to jump up and be better than you think they are.
Of course.
And the fact is, nobody knows who they'll be. If Green Bay has Aaron Rodgers, that's a difficult game. Both Seattle's are difficult. Indianapolis could be difficult because they're a team that, frankly, was giving people fits last year.
Totally. Tennessee can be difficult.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how the 49ers tackled Derrick Henry 25 times. It's just that when we talk about these schedules, we talk about them as though time stopped a year ago, and you have to sit there and disbelieve your own eyes over and over again to conclude that somebody's got a tough schedule or an easy schedule. And it's even harder this year because there are no teams that are on the road 3 weeks in a row. Apparently, the NFL took that out of their planning this year. And there are no teams, you know, not only that, but playing on the opposite coast 3 weeks in a row. It's a relatively easier schedule for everybody, but it's always going to be easier for the best teams. And the 49ers have to prove that, as they did in 2019, they have to overcome a bad record from the year before. So, and that's, you know, I mean, I haven't looked this up yet, but that's a yo-yo team twice. And it looks like they could do it, but I don't know how easy that is, and I don't know how often it is.
We know why they yo-yoed. The first year you're talking about, their starting quarterback went down. The other year you're talking about, their starting quarterback and basically the rest of the football team around him went down. They didn't yo-yo because they're an inconsistent performer or an inconsistently coached team. They just had inconsistent talent.
Well, I think that's true of every team that yo-yos, is that you don't have talent that's accessible to you. So the question becomes whether they can stay 2019 healthy with these guys. And that can't be predicted by anybody, which is why the idea of, well, this looks like a very easy schedule, is just, it's a myth. You can't do it unless you're doing what you're doing, which is basically saying, oh, no, they'll win everything because they're swell.
Right. Look, I agree with you. If the Rams, Jaguars, Vikings, Bengals, Falcons, and Titans, and Texans are all undefeated, at which time they're playing the 49ers.
If Houston's undefeated.
That'd be pretty impressive, right? Yeah. They don't seem until week 17.
Then everybody has to apologize to Jack Easterby forever.
Ever. Ever. Jack Easterby gets a free lunch no matter where he is. But if those teams are obviously much better than we think they're going to be, everything changes. Here's what's not going to be changing. The nation's eyes are going to be upon the 49ers, a maxed out five times. There are five primetime games, two Sunday nighters, two Monday nighters, and a Thursday nighter as well. They've got five 10 a.m. games, two of which they'll have out of their way after the first 2 weeks of football. They're obviously have a 10 a.m. game in Detroit, and then they're going to have a 10 a.m. game in Philadelphia the very next week because probably they're going to stay in Youngstown or go back to West Virginia and stay at the Greenbrier again, Ray. They're really not going to have to worry about the second 10 a.m. kickoff, and really you don't need to worry about the first one either because you can fly in the day before. You know, the first time is kind of where your body clock sets. It's when things get different than your normal body clock. So I'm not worried about that first kickoff. I'm not worried about that second early kickoff. They get an early kickoff in Chicago, week 8, early kickoff against the Jaguars, early kickoff against the Bengals. Here's the thing. A 10 a.m. kickoff used to be a cross-country flight for the 49ers used to be a death sentence. It's not anymore. I'm less worried about an early body clock game than I have been in a really long time. And I believe Shanahan is like 7-2 or 6-2 in his last 8 or so 10 a.m. starts. He was really bad in the beginning, but again, he had bad teams in the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, on its face, this looks like a doable schedule. It's just on its face is always the best way to say I'm about to say something that can't be proven.
You're right. And on its face, Ray, new faces means, by definition, Kyle Shanahan has some easy, at least, coaching advantages built in to the year. Kyle Shanahan has five of his games against first-year head coaches. There are a total of seven first-year head coaches coming into the NFL this year, and Kyle's got five of them on his schedule. Dan Campbell, Detroit, obviously. Nick Sirianni, Philadelphia. First two games are against neophyte coaches. Arthur Smith, Atlanta, it's his first year. David Culley, Houston, his first year. Urban Meyer, obviously his first year. The quick turnaround, the short week, there aren't multiple ones of them. They don't have two Thursday nighters, thank goodness. Well, I think no one has two Thursday nighters.
No, they never do that to teams.
Right. But there isn't one of those extreme, you have three games in 17 days types of schedule. Their bye week doesn't really serve them very well by being so early in the year, or maybe it does. Who knows? You got to see the weeks play out to know when you could use a rest, I would guess. But they don't have that bye week that trims rest time or anything like that. It's a very good schedule, like you said, on its face, whatever that means.
Yeah. It's easy up front, again, assuming that Green Bay doesn't have Aaron Rodgers. If it does, it's more difficult.
Hey, even if they do have Aaron Rodgers usually comes to play the 49ers out on the West Coast and stinks.
Well, he doesn't stink. His teammates stink. But
I don't think Kyle Shanahan sits around and looks at Aaron Rodgers as this unbeatable, unmovable, undefeatable force that other teams look at him.
No, but it's a thing you've got to prepare more for.
Of course.
You know, I mean, Seattle at Arizona. Arizona always gives them more trouble than they want, but they usually figure out a way to escape.
What I like in those weeks, by the way, 4-5, you got Seattle week 4, Arizona week 5. I feel like the advantages that Russell Wilson and Kyler Murray have is that they just are kind of different speeds, different breeds of quarterback. Facing them in back-to-back weeks, I think I like it a little bit more than spacing them out, because you don't have to go back to, all right, well, you know, today we're hitting a fastball guy, but tomorrow that knuckleballer is going to screw us up for the next three games, isn't he?
I suppose it could, although they're different kinds of quarterbacks.
They are.
They don't break out of the pocket the same way. I mean, Russell Wilson breaks out of the pocket with an idea toward figuring out a new place to throw, whereas Kyler Murray, when he gets out, you know, while he can throw, he also doesn't mind putting the ball under his hand. So they're, I don't think the prep time for those two guys is necessarily as easy as it looks, but it's not the same as a guy who's going to just sit in the pocket like Ryan Tannehill all day.
You can't help but look at the schedules and start looking around at other teams' schedules. And there are two games that just jump out. We're going to have a big test in the AFC week one. We've got Browns at Chiefs. The Cleveland Browns walk into that stadium and win. Oh my gosh. We're going to have to take them very, very seriously, whether you want it to or not. If the Chiefs win, I think that's what everyone's expecting. No one would be surprised by that. The margin of victory over the Browns, people will, you know, they'll be harshly judging. We all know everyone will try to be declaring who doesn't win the Super Bowl week one based on the outcome of that game. There is another game, though. And it's almost a shame, Ray, that it's happening so early in the year, because you know that the NFL, I mean, they wanted this. They wanted this on the schedule, and they could have put it everywhere they wanted, because it's hands down the biggest lean forward moment, I think, of the regular season. You know what I'm talking about, don't you? It's Tom Brady's return to New England.
Yeah.
Tom Brady is going back to New England with the Buccaneers week four. And right now, the ticket prices are already absolutely insane for that game.
300s already.
Well,
for the worst seats in the house.
No, Ray, it's much worse than that. So, like, if you wanted to go see the Dolphins-Patriots, the best seat at Foxborough, you know, that comes with all the parking, all the food, probably get a free foam finger to wave or whatever, all your right this way, Mr. Mercedes. The best tickets in the ballpark are about $3,000. $3,000, that's an expensive day. The cheapest are about $325 at Foxborough. It's an expensive day. For the Patriots, the same seat against Miami that would be $3,000 is going for about $9,000. And the same seat.